This Washington Post Live podcast is sponsored by EY. Find out how you can have the confidence in the opportunities AI brings with EY.ai.
You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the newsroom to you live.
Hello and welcome to Washington Post Live. I'm Kat Zakreski, National Tech Policy Reporter here at the Washington Post. I'm joined today by Ginni Rometty, the former chair, CEO, and president of IBM, and now co-chair of 110 and author of Good Power. Ginni, thank you so much for being here with me today.
Thanks, Kat. My pleasure. I think you guys do a great job with these webcasts.
Oh, well, thank you. And this is a particularly special one for me because you were actually my college commencement speaker back at Northwestern. And that day you talked a little bit about artificial intelligence because it was shortly after Watson had won Jeopardy. And I just wanted to ask you, I mean, it's been almost 13 years now since Watson won Jeopardy. That was most Americans' introduction to natural language processing. What advice do you have for Sam Altman and the other CEOs at the forefront of this new wave of generative AI?
That is so funny you remember that. And I have to tell you, what I learned over this whole decade, and even back then, to me, so many of the points are still true today. And my advice would be how this is introduced matters a lot. The goal you set for the technology matters, because somewhere along the line, we've decided that the goal is to replace people. It does not have to be that way. In fact, you might remember, Kat, I originally called this cognitive computing, not artificial intelligence. We were trying to get away from the thought that this technology should replace people and that instead it was to help you make better decisions. And so if we all set that goal and how we introduced it to our firms and to the world, that it's to make you better, you really would do different things. So I think a different goal, how it's introduced, making it explainable. And in their little intro, I think it does really kind of go back to the thought of all the effort should be on how to trust the technology, because this is not going to be a technology issue of the technology itself. It's going to be trust.
And I want to dig into that point a little bit because many Americans are worried about the impact AI will have on their jobs. A recent poll posted by CNBC found that nearly half of CEOs, 49%, say AI could effectively replace, quote, most or even, quote, all of their roles. Do you think every employee from top to bottom eventually gets affected by AI?
Look, I don't think they get replaced, but I think AI will do a little piece of their job. And I think that is a bit of what is different, although I've always felt this about AI, that it would change. Yes, there'll be some jobs that are replaced, all right, with automation, and this happens with every cycle. But the big point is, more than other technologies, this will impact a piece of what you do. So sort of the non-routine problem solving and decision making, which falls in lots of jobs. So I do understand why people have a fear out there. Like you, I mean, I see studies, I don't believe about it replacing every CEO's job. I don't agree with that statement, but there's plenty of people who feel it's going to impact their job. And I go back to part of that has happened by the way it was introduced, because it was just unleashed. And if you think about it, one of my favorite stats is it took Netflix 3.5 years to get to 1 million users. Chat did that in 5 days. So now, you know, and it's at 180 million now, you have all this exposure, and it's really for a whole group of people that aren't prepared for it. And Kissinger had a great quote, what people don't understand, they fear or revolt. And so I think part of this is now backing up a little bit and going through what does it do best, because I have a great hope for it. So assuming we deal with this downside on how it's introduced and the bad things that can happen, the upside, Kat, I believe, is it could be a great equalizer. And you're beginning to see studies on this. I saw it even a decade ago, which even then AI could help you make better decisions than you could by yourself. And the thought that you could take sort of, if I can just say it this way, the bottom half performing of an organization and move them up a couple quartiles, that's a huge, not just a productivity, but it means I as a person could get a better job. I can do a better job. I could make more money. And that's what I mean by it being a great equalizer. And it gets to the point when you introduce me about hiring people for their skills, not just their degrees.
Yes, I want to dig into that a little bit more. Can you tell us more about that view and what you think it would mean to hire people based on skills, not degrees?
Yeah. This is, to me, fundamental point. Honestly, I even would link it to the future of democracy. So that sounds lofty, but let me back up. You know, right now, if you look at in this country, and I've really been working on this about 15 years, and I stumbled upon it almost 15 years ago as we were looking for cyber talent, and they didn't exist at the time yet. And we started working with high schools and community colleges and found people were able to do this work. And then found over time, they did go back and get more education. And this was really an issue of their access, not their aptitude, which has proven to be true now in 30 countries around the world. And if you consider in the US, 65% of people don't have a college degree, 80% of Black Americans don't. And then my big sort of, aha, and it's what I do now, is that so many of us, good paying, a job that could raise a family of four, 80% of those jobs require a college degree. In my experience, and I think what I'm finding with all the companies I'm working with, about half of those are over-credentialed, meaning you don't need a college degree to get started. Now, I spoke at your commencement. I am vice chair at Northwestern. It's not that I don't believe in a college degree and that I don't believe that everyone should have a right. Put that aside, do. But where we stand right now, if people don't think they have a better future, they look for alternatives. And that's what I meant by this is also, in my mind, linked to the fact about democracy. That's why you believe in democracy. You have a better future. So skills first means, wait a second, if jobs are over-credentialed, I can get people the skills to get started. So many people could have a better job. It meant hire me for my skill. I do have to get some skill. And we can talk about education policy and the like. And then hire me for skill, not just my degree, so that where I start doesn't determine necessarily where I end. And this thought, and again, you mentioned it in my intro, with skills changing so fast, 3 to 5 years, all of us are going to have to keep going back to school or learning a new trade. So it won't be once and done for education. And that's why I link AI and skills first very tightly together, because wait a second, with AI, I can get some assistance on doing my job, and therefore I can start to do things perhaps with less formal education. And then over time, that can I can either work, go back to school, but be very experience-based. And more people, there's great talent pools of people out there, because I should go back and say my experience with Skills First is more retentive, more loyal, take more education, over time performed the same as many of my degreed employees. So it's a win-win and a more diverse workforce.
And so on this point right now, it requires an entire rethinking though of how corporate America has operated for many years. I mean, which companies in addition to IBM do you view as really at the forefront of this shift?
You know, and this is where our work with 110, which is we just started, it was actually on the heels of when George Floyd was murdered, to say, where can we make a big impact? And we said, let's start with Black Americans and let's work with all companies to say, let's move to skills first. And if you do that, you're going to open up all these talent pools there. But by the way, this is true for every underrepresented group that's out there. So it is to raise all boats. And so when you say which companies are doing a great job, I mean, I look just at some of our 110 membership, whether it's AT&T, whether it's Cleveland Clinic, whether, yes, it's IBM, whether it's Merck as a drug company. There's a long list of companies that are Delta Airlines, I think really progressing on this thought. My favorite on Delta is having removed the requirement for pilots. And it doesn't mean a pilot can't fly and doesn't have the right education, but there's many ways to get that. And so I think you're seeing many great American companies, General Motors, all stand up to this thought and realize it's a great talent pool for them.
And I wanted to ask, you mentioned early in the conversation that AI is going to affect many jobs. I wanted to get a sense of how you're using AI in your own work. Do you use ChatGPT and does it enhance what you do?
Yeah. So look, I think if I said, even for my own, whether it's personal or my own work, you know, when I think of my business work, summarizing things. When I think of personal, I've been married almost 45 years. My husband and I redid our vows. I'm like, how do you write a ceremony? And because I was obviously going to have to write his part too. And I got a great starting point. And there's a lesson in that. I think the best uses for generative AI have a lot to do with ideation. And so part of this maturing of understanding the technology is knowing what it's best at. And so on the other hand, if you said, give me the best strategy for XYZ, I don't consider it the best at that. And again, you're starting to see research on use the technology for what it is good at. And ideation is one of those areas. I do a lot of work in healthcare here, and it's why you see, I think the patient, this will be the last area that it hits from the perspective of when people say, oh, well, this will replace my doctor. I go back to the word trust, and I go back to, I think, another learning I had early on with AI. Tolerance for error, because even then AI could make better decisions. But when it's a very substantial or a consequential decision for you, healthcare, financials, your tolerance for error is very small. Even knowing a human could have a bigger error rate than the technology, if you said, gee, use this technology for healthcare, but it could be wrong 10, 15% of the time, you'd say, no, no, no. And so this issue of it's going to get used in areas that are, you're going to have a, you know, what I would say, a lower tolerance, right? I mean, a higher tolerance for no error. And so this tolerance question is, I think, really key. And so I use it, as I said, either ideation or areas where I can judge myself with facts, whether what I'm reading is exactly right or wrong. I always say my very first time I ever used it, I was teaching my husband. I said, who's Mark Rometty? The first answer was everything he did to run IBM. Now, look, he said, oh, yes, so finally someone gives me credit. But that the point was, it sort of assumed he was a man, right? And this is early, early days, but it was wrong. Now it's not wrong anymore, but that's my point. So I use it, I think, mostly for me, it's for ideation to get started is where I use it today.
That makes sense. And we heard that IBM is going to start using generative AI in some of their marketing materials. What are some of the areas you think we'll see companies roll out generative AI initially?
Look, I think you're going to find it across many areas. And there's a lot of area and focus on automation. So things that could easily, you know, rules are clear and explainable. You will see that work get replaced. I saw, you know, you mentioned the studies earlier. There was a study, I'm trying to remember, it was Gallup maybe, and it had a piece on CHROs that said, gee, 80% of our people, their jobs will be impacted. And if you think of a typical HR organization, one that maybe hasn't progressed as much to advice and is still dealing with a lot of administration, there is probably a lot of function that could be replaced with a generative AI system. But then it should free people up to do what people do best, which is decision making. And it's what you would have preferred your HR professionals to be doing anyways. So I think you're gonna see, yes, there's gonna be this first range of automation, this first range of customer service. Look, there are a lot of customer service jobs that are actually very complex and people want to do a good job. It's not fair, they can't have all that memorized. And so that assistant is going to make them a better job. I go back to where I started. BCG has a great study on this, by the way, about it being, my word, an equalizer to help people do their job better. And I saw this in the very early days with AI, and it mattered how the company brought it into the workforce. If they co-created the new work so that the people trusted the technology, knew how it was trained, changed their workflow with it. My favorite example was a unionized workforce that wholly embraced it. And that's because of the way it was introduced. And like I said, most people want to do a better job at what they do. It allowed them to answer more questions, to be correct, feel good about their work. And that to me is if you start to introduce it that way and you'll see it in those simple ways, I think is the way to get started. So you'll see customer service. You'll see, I think, summarization of manuals and the like. And that'll be your starting point. And then just be sure, I know you're going to have Dragos, I think, on from the EU, perhaps, I hope, hopefully after me, right? I mean, but the more important the question, right? I think the way you regulate this technology is by how it's used. So in other words, the more consequential its use, then there should be accountability and liability for your actions with it. You know, I'm used to being around banks. They are audited. They need to be able to say what they do, you know, when they lend, there's not discrimination and the like. You're gonna have to apply that same kind of thinking with these technologies.
And so on that point, you just brought up the EU and the work that they've been doing on AI regulation, and they've obviously taken a risk-based approach, banning, yes, you know, the most risky uses like a social credit scoring system, and then, you know, having different limitations based on the other applications. And so I guess from your perspective, should U.S. lawmakers who are considering AI regulation, should they look to that EU model as they approach this domestically?
Look, yes, I have a lot to say on this. I believe trying to regulate a technology itself, by in other words saying, you know, register your algorithm or license it, is a fool's errand. It's not going to be successful, and it's going to limit the amount of innovation here. On the other hand, a risk-based approach or usage-based, whichever word you'd like to use, I think is the way to regulate this technology. So it's by use case, right? So the riskier the case, now whether ban or not is the right word or what you do, but the riskier it is, then you've got to have different sets of criteria around this. And there should be liability then in these cases, or accountability. And I think this is what we did not do with social media, and we wish we did. And this is why I say you've got to manage the upside and the downside in parallel. This is our big chance to do that with this technology. So we know it can be incorrect. It will get better over time. But I go back to that word trust. If it's not explainable, people aren't going to trust it. And there's a difference in this moment, right? You've now got the ability to spread disinformation so fast, and you've got foreign actors. We've got all these elections in the world. So you've got the confluence of this technology coming out at a time when there's more elections, I think, than there's ever been in history, maybe across the world at one time. The desire to, you know, interfere with some of that by different players is high. Misinformation. So in this moment, it's really important to me that you watch the ups and the downs, and that there be regulation. Now, obviously in the US, there has not been national regulation, right? Just like we still don't have national privacy regulation. And I think Europe will probably end up setting that global standard. They were first with privacy, if you think about it, with GDPR. And what happened over time, the US had states do different things like California, but pretty much GDPR has become a global standard, the global data protection regulation that came out of Europe. And now you see this with AI. And I think they're on the right track about this idea that it should be risk-based and have some accountability that's part of it. And that will, in my mind, likely then set the global standard here. So you're going to watch what Europe does.
And so on your point that we have so many elections this year, obviously the US in November, but India, the EU, many Yes. other global elections coming up, what steps should the companies be taking right now, absent regulation, to avoid that flood of disinformation that you just warned about?
Yeah, I don't know that I have a silver bullet answer to you on that, other than I go back to, as you think about how these technologies are introduced, it is just educating people on how they actually work. And so, you know, telling people, look for trusted sources when you do this, and in where you go to your news sources. It is education around that. Yes, will there be things on the edges you're going to be able to do to stop some of it, potentially, in the way you do some of your own policing? Yes. But I think that will move faster than the solutions are going to move. So I was, Kat, I had an interesting interview, and a journalist was telling me about a five-year-old in school. They were starting to try to teach them what did it mean to have a trusted source online. And the kids were writing about some fictitious animal that they actually could find data that looked real, that this animal existed, and write a report. And the truth was the animal never existed. And they were trying to teach kids at an early age, right, that start to learn that you've got to be discriminating, and, you know, what is a quote trusted source. And so my answer, I guess, in a word, is education, right? Is probably going to be your best inoculation on this topic, but the pace it's moved is going to make that difficult.
And we're almost out of time, but I wanted to, on that point, bring in one question from the audience. Sarah Campbell from Mississippi asks, how can educators best prepare students for effective use of AI in their future career pursuits?
Listen, I love that question. That's a great question to end on, because if I was giving a graduation speech, like you said earlier, you know, I would have said the most valuable skill you could have is to just be an Olympic learner and love to learn. And so to me, the fundamental change to education as a result of these technologies, it's going to take us back to teaching critical thinking. Forget about kids having to memorize and all of that. It's really going to be now more about you having really honed your judgment skills. And that is what humans do best. And so this is where my optimistic side comes back through. And I think for education, fine, embrace it. Take the drudgery out of the part of education and instead work with students on really highlighting again what I think in the old world would have been taught is critical thinking on everything. And so that's what I do as an educator. And I think we're going to end up then with a generation that just loves to learn, and it's going to be in a fast-paced world that changes so much. That's what I would do.
Got it. Well, Jenny, unfortunately, we're out of time for this segment, so we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today at Post Live.
Thank you.
And thank all of you for joining us at home. Please stay tuned for our next segment about regulation of AI in the European Union.
The following segment was produced and paid for by a Washington Post Live event sponsor. The Washington Post newsroom was not involved in the production of this content.
Hello and welcome. I'm Suzanne Kelly, CEO and publisher of the Cipher Brief, a national security-focused news organization. You know, we're all really seeing the pace of transformation accelerate when it comes to artificial intelligence. Organizations are really turning their focus now toward implementing AI at scale in order to really understand its true value, but they still have to do it in a responsible way. So what are the critical success factors? Well, joining me to talk about this is Nicola Morini-Bianzino, EY's Global Chief Technology Officer. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Suzanne.
I thought we'd start off really by talking about kind of the basics. What are some of the factors that organizations should be keeping in mind when they're thinking about scaling their AI applications?
So there are some characteristics that I think are common of any technology scaling within the enterprise. Some others are specific to this technology. So for example, like, you know, the first one is ambition, right? So how aggressively, how fast do you want to be in this space? So you hear, you know, different perspectives. Some companies want to be early adopters. Some other, they want to be fast followers, right? So that doesn't change that much with this technology. But there are other elements that are very, very different. So one is around risk, for example, right? So this technology has the potential. So because, first of all, we need to understand that this is not deterministic technology, it's probabilistic technology, meaning that, you know, it doesn't matter how many times you repeat the process, you know, you can have different outcomes every single time. And so there is an element of risk that organizations need to manage. You don't want to be on the cover page because, you know, you've been coming across as biased, racist, you know, or violating, you know, values or ethical norms, etc. So that is a very, very important thing to keep in mind and manage within the enterprise, because the consequences are big. And the other one is that this technology is really about also how an organization is able to adopt it culturally, right? So this technology goes at the heart of the way we work and what do we are as human being, how we use knowledge, how do we interact with the technology itself and, you know, and the technology as and other people. And so if we need to be ready culturally to adopt it. And then the last part is that if this is mainly, of course, for global organization, the implications of a global deployment are really big. So the geographical elements and the different regulations across countries have a really big impact on what can you do and you cannot do. And this is going to evolve very fast as well in the future.
I'm very curious about the EY.AI Confidence Index. What is that? And does this have a role here as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, this is our framework to manage risk of an AI deployment. And so think about it as a sort of a roadmap of the key things you need to think about when you deploy a solution. So, for example, what's the cybersecurity posture? You know, what is the data? What are the data elements that are going to go into the solution, right? Are you tracking and understanding the impact of the solution itself and so on, right? So it's a risk framework. And the way we do it at the specific solution level, because we believe, and we actually get a great traction in the marketplace with this concept, is that the confidence level that people can accept for AI solution varies depending on the solution itself, right? So if you're doing some, you know, very advanced sales forecasting and the prediction is not exactly accurate, okay, you can take it, right? If you're doing something a little bit more, you know, sensitive around finance, you don't want to do anything that is not 100% accurate in that space, right? So the risk tolerance is different across enterprises. And so that's what the confidence index is focused on.
That makes a lot of sense. Let me dig in on something you said earlier, which is you don't want to find your company or your organization on the front page of the paper for doing something wrong. So how should you be thinking about safeguards? How can businesses put those into place so that they're ethical and responsible and they don't have one of those oops moments?
Yeah, so I think this is actually one area where there is a significant mismatch of expectations and what can be done technically, right, in the system. So these systems really are, I mean, it's unfortunate, but that's the way they are constructed. And it's their beauty in the sense that, you know, that's how they become so creative, is because they're sort of black boxes, right? So you don't really know what's happening inside the black box. And so how do you manage that is the million-dollar question, right? And so when people talk about responsibility, transparency, you know, all these things are absolutely critical and they should be front and center. But there is still a lot of technology complexity to make it happen. So that's why we use the AI Confidence Index, because it allows at least to say, if you follow these steps, there is a high chance that the solution is, you know, is it doesn't do the bad things that you, you know, that might happen, right? Okay, so I think that is kind of the framework that we use to think about it, but there is no absolute certainty. So that's why we don't talk about trust in this space, which is, you know, trust is very binary, but we talked about confidence, right? It's a different level of confidence that an organization is able to accept.
It really feels in a lot of ways like we're still at the dawn of AI. And I'm wondering, where do you see things 1 year from now, for example, from a business perspective?
I think the pace of evolution of technology will be growing exponentially. We will, you know, we're going to be blown away from what's going to happen in the next 2-3 years. And there is nobody, I think, that can exactly forecast what's happening. So there is, I think there is an impending hardware revolution happening, right? So I think in the next year or two, we're going to see a hardware that is very, very different and will manage AI in a different way and give us more opportunities there. I think the LLMs are an enormous breakthrough, right? They're great, but still use human language, which is by definition slow, and it doesn't convey all the information. It's imprecise. So I think there will be a machine-to-machine new semantic language that is going to emerge. So anyway, but I actually don't know what's going to happen. That's the beauty of it. So we need to be following the space very closely. And for organizations, what I tell them is that you need to be quick, right? You need to set the foundations on how you're going to react, because these things are going to move at a speed that we haven't never seen before.
I completely agree with that. Nicola Morini-Bianzino is EY's Global Chief Technology Officer. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes to talk to us about this today.
Thank you, Suzanne.
I'm Suzanne Kelly with the Cypher Brief. Now back to my colleagues at the Washington Post.
And now back to Washington Post Live.
Hello and welcome back to Post Live. For those of you just joining us, I'm Kat Zakreski, National Tech Policy Reporter here at the Washington Post. I'm joined now by Dragos Todoroke. Dragos is the co-rapporteur on the EU AI Act, and he is a member of the European Parliament. Minister, thank you so much for joining us today at Post Live.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's wonderful to see you again. And I know that you are joining us now after you were just in a session at the EU about the EU AI Act. Can you tell our viewers a little bit about what the status of this legislation is right now?
It's true. I just walked out of what is, in fact, the last debate on the AI Act. What is customary is that for the very important legislative proposals, just before the final vote, which is going to take place tomorrow, we have a final debate, and we've just had it. It cements, in a way, the positions of the major political groups just before the vote takes place. That means that tomorrow we will be more or less signing up on the historical landmark legislation. And from tomorrow onwards, basically, the law becomes official, it is adopted, and then from that moment onwards, the implementation period starts.
And so this is a very significant moment after years of work dating back to before the pandemic on artificial intelligence in Europe. For some of our viewers who are just tuning in, can you walk us through what the EU AI Act will do, what protections it will offer European citizens from AI?
To understand it in the right way, you have to think of risk. And we often say that the AI Act is a risk-based approach, because we looked at the technology and we said trying to regulate the technology itself would not be the right way about it. And Therefore, we looked at the uses of technology. And we asked ourselves the question, what are those uses that actually bring about risks, that bring harms to the values that we want to protect in our democracy, to the rights of the citizens, to the interests of society, and what kind of rules we can put around these risks so that we mitigate them, at the same time trying also not to put unnecessary barriers to innovation. So it's been from the very beginning a very delicate balancing act between the objective of putting the safeguards in place and the objective of creating the right enablers and the right ecosystem for innovation in Europe. And what the law does is basically categorize the different contexts in which AI can be used and say, what are those applications that are so incongruent with the values that we are protecting through legislation that we simply say they are going to be prohibited on our market. So we have a list of prohibitions on the use of AI, and some examples are social scoring, for example, the like of what happens in China, which we say is so detrimental to how we understand the role and the rights of citizens in a society that we don't want to see that use of technology in the Union. And other similar applications, such as emotional recognition, such as predictive policing, that we're simply prohibiting them. We're putting a ban on their use on our market. Then we have a broader category of uses of AI that we consider to be high risk, which doesn't mean that they will not be able to be developed, to be deployed on our market, but they will have to come with safeguards. And those safeguards are mostly centered on transparency, on explainability, which essentially brings about trust. And we always talk about trustworthy AI. That is the fundamental element of this legislation. We want society, we want citizens to trust their interaction with technology, because we also realize that AI is going to be present in services, in products, in our everyday lives, in our economies, in our workplace, and therefore we want people to trust it. So these rules, these obligations, which we consider to be considerate, reasonable, light touch, so that, again, we don't put unnecessary barriers, but necessary, again, to protect those rights and those interests that we want to protect. And then, again, there are important enablers for innovation. We have in regulation the same sandboxes. We have specific provisions for small and medium enterprises because we want to level up the playing field between the smaller and the bigger players in the AI market. So things that, again, are also meant to cater for that objective of promoting innovation in Europe also through the use of this legislation, through the standards that are going to be put on the market, creating predictability for those developing and deploying AI. And last but not least, we have approached the issue of what we call foundation models, what others call frontier models. It's these models that we now see more and more around us, from ChatGPT to Gemini to Llama. So these models, which are sitting at the heart of many other applications, and therefore we consider that they need themselves to go through certain requirements, through certain rules and accountability, because, again, of the impact that they have with their versatility, with their potency on myriads of other use cases and applications that we'll be building on top of these models.
And so I want to focus on that point about foundation models, because obviously this was one of the most controversial points of the negotiations back in December. And we saw that this legislation first was introduced in draft form before the release of ChatGPT and before we were in this current AI craze around generative AI. And so just thinking about that and how you've had to adapt the legislation over the last year or so, I mean, how are you sure that this will be future-proof and able to encompass new technologies that might arise in future years?
It's true that we started paying attention to these models before, in fact, the launch of ChatGPT, which kind of brought everyone's attention to the topic of these models and the impact that they have. And then every other jurisdiction around the world started organizing their thinking around what kind of governance needs to be put in place to cater for those models. But again, we had been starting to consider whether to introduce rules about foundation models in the regulation, because they were not there in the initial draft, in the initial proposal coming from the European Commission. So in Parliament, through the work of a special committee on AI, which I had the honor of chairing, in the European Parliament, we started looking at what could be a special regime, a special set of responsibilities, of accountability that we put around these models. And we have finally found that regime. We finally found a way of dealing with the models, creating the right differentiation between the what we consider the top tier model, the one that are very powerful, very potent, that also can bring about risks that are systemic in our societies and that we need to find right way to address them, but and also those of a lower magnitude, which also need to go through certain transparency requirements, but at a lower level of intensity as the top models. And as to the future proofing, this has been not only for foundation models, but generally for the whole regulation, this has been a very important element in our thinking, because we realize that this is a technology that is very fluid, that is going to constantly evolve and leap forward. And therefore, we wanted to make sure that these rules, these obligations, stand the test of time, and also that we introduce the right level of adaptability of the norms to make sure that these evolutions will be properly accompanied. And we have done that by introducing mandate. This is a possibility that we have in the EU legislative process. We introduce mandates in the legislation that allows afterwards for the regulators to adapt the technical parts of the regulation to the evolution of technology. And we've done that for the description of the use cases, which are considered to be high risk, so that in case there are newer contexts in which AI is used and is bringing about the risk, so that we can add those new contexts to the legislation, to the list of high risk. Also, maybe others will prove in time to be adapting to a point where they no longer are high risk. And therefore, we can also take them out of the list of high risk applications. And also, very importantly, we use technical criteria, for example, to differentiate or to define what a foundation model is. And we also realize that with the speed of technology changing, with the speed of compute power changing, and the need for this compute to sustain development of models, we will also need to change or modify or adapt these criteria. And we have, again, introduced a mandate for that. And all of these together, I'm convinced, will allow for this technology to stay relevant 5 years, 10 years from now.
And on this point, though, I mean, we see that tech executives generally are supportive of this idea of taking a risk-based approach to regulation, of regulating the uses of technology, not the technology itself. But with foundation models, it seems like there's some resistance to this because in this instance, you're regulating the technology itself, not the uses of this. I mean, what's your response to tech executives who are worried about this and telling lawmakers here on Capitol Hill that they shouldn't follow the EU's lead when it comes to the foundation model regulations?
It is true that with foundation models, we have taken a different approach than the risk base that we use for all other types of artificial intelligence. But we had to do that because we recognize that with foundation models, there is something intrinsic to the way they are developed, to the way they are deployed, to the way they are used, as I said earlier, by many other developers of applications or systems on top of those models. And therefore, we thought that it was imperative that we introduce some sense of accountability, some responsibilities for the developers of the systems or of the models themselves. But at the same time, we recognize, again, because it is a nascent technology, because it evolves, and because we need to have a co-generation approach in the way we design not only the obligations themselves, but also how these obligations are to be respected, we recognized that we had to work hand in hand with the developers of these models, with these big tech companies that are putting on the market these models. And therefore, we have introduced something that does not exist in other EU legislation. So we have been very flexible in that respect as well. We've introduced a model of enforcement that caters for a dialogue between the regulator and the companies. It works on the basis of code of practices, which the industry itself will be developing together with the regulator. We have introduced the idea of flexible enforcement, where the regulator and the companies will be working together to identify, to analyze, to evaluate the systemic risk that some of these models might produce. And I think that this is an approach which does not close the door. On the contrary, it creates the space for dialogue, constant dialogue, with the companies developing the models, and they play a role in the governance itself, which I think is an important element. There is also an advisory board which will sit next to the regulator making these decisions, and this advisory board is going to be open to representatives from the industry. And we did that in order to bring this constant reality check from the ground, from where the technology is being developed, to bring it constantly at the level of the decision makers that will be implementing this legislation.
And I wanted to ask a bit about just timing of the EU AI Act. With the vote happening tomorrow, when will enforcement begin?
We have a phased enforcement, recognizing also that on one hand, the authorities themselves, whether national or at EU level, will have to prepare for the moment. They will be picking up these responsibilities, but also for the companies themselves, they need to adapt and prepare for the moment when these rules will be enforced. So we have a 6 month period from the date of adoption when the prohibitions will start applying, a 12 month period for the foundation models and all the regime and obligations around foundation models. They will kick in 12 months from the moment of adoption. And then the rest of the regulation will become applicable 24 months from adoption. So this is the calendar for the implementation. And these 24 months, very importantly, will also be used for developing standards, technical standards. We have given, through this legislation, a mandate to standard setting bodies, again, industry led, bottom up, to develop technical standards so that at the moment when obligations will become the norm, that they can be done on the basis of standardization that will help companies understand better what is expected of them and create the sense of predictability that we want to introduce in the market.
So, Minister, if I'm understanding correctly, some of these obligations won't take effect then until March of 2026. I mean, that's obviously a long way away, and a lot of evolution will happen in this field between now and then. I mean, how do you think of that interim time? Are regulators moving fast enough given the speed of this technology?
It's funny you ask that, because until some months ago, we were asked whether we were not moving fast. And now people are asking us whether we're not moving too slow. It's true that it seems to be a very long period for implementation. But as I said earlier, it is a period that is necessary for everyone to prepare for this moment, because it's not going to be easy for national authorities to find the right talent to bring into the future national regulators that would be implementing this law. And we want to make sure that they are properly staffed, properly equipped to handle their competencies in the right way. And again, for companies to do the same. But we have done something else. We have launched, more or less at the time when we finalized the negotiations back in December last year, we have launched something that we call the AI Pact, which is an invitation for companies that feel ready already now, that want to be early adopters of these standards, of these norms, to do so. The European Commission is also putting forward some stimulants for that. And I've just heard now from Commissioner Breton that more than 300 companies have already done so. They have already signed up on the AI Pact, announcing that they are prepared to start being in conformity with this regulation ahead of the moment when it's going to become mandatory. And I think that's an important signal. It's an important signal from the companies that they are understanding the responsibility that they have under the AI Act, and that they are already developing the tools internally inside the companies to make sure that they respect these new rules. So it's true, there's still some time before all of these rules will become mandatory, but I think this time will, number one, be used for good, because it will allow everyone to prepare for that. And number two, I think companies themselves that understand their responsibility, their accountability towards, ultimately towards the customers out there, towards individuals in society, that they can already start doing so and give an important signal of good faith to the market.
And I wanted to ask you a little bit about some of the developments related to Mistral. We saw it back in December that France and Germany had some objections to the EU AI Act because of concerns of the impact the legislation could have on national champions within Europe. Now we've learned that Mistral has taken an outside investment from a US company, Microsoft. What do you make of that deal?
Well, I won't comment on the deal itself. Every company decides its strategy and how it wants to grow and evolve further. And in fact, I think it's a good partnership. I wish both Microsoft and Mistral all the good in the world. It is ironic, nevertheless, that a lot of the resistance that had come in some of the positions expressed by some of the governments in the EU was based on this idea of us maybe limiting the space for European champions to grow. I had heard this argument over and over again in the course of the last months in 2023. And the fact that just a few weeks later, one of these champions has in a way moved across the Atlantic on the other side. But I, again, for me, what is important that we got this through, that we have a unanimity in the council representing all the governments of the member states, which actually was a very important political signal. So all of those governments that had some reservations in the course of the negotiations had eventually understood that the balance that we found, that the compromises that were made during the negotiations were the right one and were answering to the reservations that they had. And again, whether companies here or elsewhere will decide to stay or to develop their business in a different way or choose their own strategies on how to do that, that does not in any way change the course of this legislation. Also does not change a very important objective that we have in the EU, putting this legislation aside, which is that we must create the space for innovation in Europe. That's a very important and valid argument to have. And it's not only about the AI Act, it's about many other factors that are sometimes pushing companies in Europe to look for their fortunes elsewhere. It is the availability of enough funding that is open to the idea of risk, which I think is intrinsic to this business. And other elements that have to do with talent, that have to do with the right ecosystem, with the availability of data or compute power. So in fact, there is quite a lot that we still need to do, putting this legislative effort aside, that we have to do in terms of creating the ecosystem that will allow European companies to want to stay here, to want to stay and continue to innovate and grow in the European Union, rather than seek to find either funding or to partner up with other companies outside of Europe, simply because that offers better opportunities for the growth of their company.
But Minister, do you know if Microsoft and Mistral were already in negotiations back in December when you were having these talks with France?
I don't want to speculate on that, but it was already, from my point of view, and this was an argument that I was putting across in the discussions with the partners in the council, that if you looked, in fact, at the source of funding for Mistral already before the moment of the negotiations late last year or whether now, in fact, the vast majority, if not almost all of the funding of the seed money for Mistral was already coming from big investment funds in the US, many of these investment funds being also supporters of big tech companies in the US. So there was already, I think, an indication there that what we were calling back then a European champion was not necessarily European. But I want to underline something else. It's not really that important. US, EU, we are partners in this. And I have always said from the very start of this journey that if we think apart, or if we somehow understand this or see this or frame this as something else but just a healthy competition of markets, I think we would be missing entirely the whole point. The point is that we democracies, I think, can and must lead in this effort to put the right governance in place for artificial intelligence. And there we have to join up forces, both in terms of our companies working together, but also in terms of the governance frameworks that we put in place as policymakers.
Well, Minister Tutarake, we will have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today at Washington Post Live.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. For more information on our upcoming programs, go to washingtonpostlive.com.